It says a newcomer asks, along with it, a stack of 3x5 cards and some pencils. What we'd like to have people do is to write down questions that they might have about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, put them in this slot here, and then we pick a question out to be answered using AAA-approved literature and our panel of experts. That's not supposed to be funny. This week's question is, what is the alumni, what is its purpose of attendance for outpatient rehab, aftercare, and Sandy is going to answer that for us.
Hello, I'm Sandy and I'm an alcoholic. Alumni is a place that is mandatory if you're in one of the homes around here. it's to see where, this is my opinion only, by the way, this is to see the people that have gone through the homes, who come back and celebrate their birthday the last Thursday of the month. And I'm going to just assume this is the person. They want to know why outpatient has to go. And if you are a part of CVRS, Central Valley Recovery Services, because it's mandatory. And if I have to, you have to.
Thank you, Sandy. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, the undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. And now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member of the fellowship since 2008. Currently treasurer of the Fresno County Young People in AA, he's been a secretary for numerous groups as well as a sponsor. His AA motto is, easy does it, but do it. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from the Sierra Fellowship, Rob S.
How's it going? Thanks a lot. I'm Rob S., and I'm a grateful alcoholic. First of all, I want to thank Bill and the Valley Group for asking me here. I appreciate it. I appreciate any opportunity to be of service. I'm just going to start at the beginning. I'm an alcoholic from a long line of alcoholics. There's a lot of people in my family who had drinking issues. My grandfather died of cirrhosis liver at 44. I had a vague notion that me and alcohol may have not been a good idea from very early on, from stuff that was told to me by my family. My father also had a drinking issue. My mom's on both sides, both grandfathers. So all throughout my life, I've heard like negative things about drinking. And for the most part, like in high school, I got drunk like a few times. I got to be honest, but where I grew up, we didn't have a lot of money, and I went to Sanger High. If anybody's familiar with that area, I went to Sanger High my first 2 years. Went to Clovis West my last 2 years. It was a big culture shock for me switching from schools, and didn't really like drink, like I said, a bunch in high school. So ended up going to college, went to college in San Diego. While I was down there, I still didn't drink, couldn't call home for $100 when I was in college. The whole time growing up, I had a lot of resentments towards specifically, different family members, but specifically towards my father. That was a big one. Got into college, didn't drink actually until I was 21, like I said. Then when I turned 21, basically I started drinking, and I had problems from right out of the gate. And the issue was, I was telling myself that, well, you know, I haven't been drinking since I was like 16, since like everybody else, right? So that's why this stuff is happening. I got blood alcohol poisoning at 22. I got a .376. I figured that, you know, I just, like I said, was behind the curve. And I say that not because it's necessary for you to have blood alcohol poisoning in order to be an alcoholic, but if you have had it, it might be a good indicator. You know, basically, moving on from there, I got out of college, I got a decent job, and I had way too much disposable income. I was living in the Bay Area, and living with some guys, basically, we worked hard and we partied hard. And we had, like, the setup with the mirrored coffee table, and that's a separate issue, I'm not going to get into it. But, I mean, you can do the math. So, you know, basically what I quickly found out there was I couldn't do that and also keep a job. And what I found out was, you know, I was able to stop that, but I kept drinking. And so I got my first DUI at 25. Again, I say that not because it's necessary for you to have a DUI in order to be an alcoholic, but if you have several, it might be a good indicator. I got my next one about a year and a half later while I was still on probation for the first one. They gave me like 45 days community service for that. I did not do it. I did about a week of it. I was working on a project up in Canada. While I was up there in Canada, a friend of mine came back from Vegas, and we were coming back on the same flight, and they like wiped his car down, and they wiped his car down, and they noticed some substance on his card, and so they decided to run both of our background checks. I was up there on a NAFTA work permit. What they found was that I had DUIs. DUIs in Canada are basically equivalent to felonies, so they deported me from Canada. So they took me to a hotel room, put me in there with a RCMP, and sent me back. And I just remember thinking this whole time, I'm like, I'm really unlucky. You know, I mean, I'm really unlucky. I mean, I got two DUIs, and now I'm like, George Bush gets a DUI, I can't come to Canada. I don't know what's going on. So I didn't think it was a big deal, but I just thought, well, you know, I'm just really unlucky is what I thought the whole time, quite frankly. And what I didn't notice, and I notice it now looking back, is that my drinking, when I took narcotics out of the equation, I never drank healthily, never drank healthily. But certainly after I took narcotics out of the equation, my drinking went through the roof. Like I drank like how I used. That's my experience. That might not be your experience. But when I was in the middle of that, I could not tell that that was happening. And you know, and I just was confused. I was like, why am I keep getting into these situations? And so basically, after getting deported from Canada, coming back, not being able to maintain my job, this was in about 2004 in the Bay Area, I had to move home. I did a geographic, moved back to Fresno. I'm on my mom's couch at in the trailer park in Kaua, over there on Chestnut Church, if anybody's familiar with it. You know, I spent about a year on her couch at 28. And for me, after, you know, putting myself through college, that was pretty demoralizing for me. And still, after getting the second DUI, I remember, basically, let me back up a second. After getting the second DUI, I didn't do any of that community service. I came back. I had to do 26 days in county in Milpitas. When I did 26 days in county in Milpitas, I'm like, I am not a criminal. I'm not supposed to be in jail. And I remember doing some writing in there, and the writing goes like, I still remember it. It says, I don't like orange clothes. I don't like watching Telemundo. I don't like cold bologna sandwiches, right? I don't know what it is that I'm so angry about, but whatever it is, it's not worth my freedom. And whatever it is, I'm, you know, if it's my family, I don't got to see them no more. Whatever it is, I'm going to unplug from this, and I'm going to quit drinking while I figure all this stuff out. Well, I got out of there, and I was drinking again within about a month. And I still have that writing. So come back to Fresno. Took me about 9 months to get another job in Fresno. Had my car repossessed. Got that job. Working for a few years, putting a little money in my pocket, but still now, and in Fresno telling myself, well, I'm not doing any narcotics, I'm just drinking, and everything's alright. And now stuff is starting to happen, like I come into work, like hungover multiple times, basically people notice this, someone at work asked me, hey, you need to sign a piece of paper here, it says, if you come into work drunk or hungover anymore, you're gonna get fired. And I thought, I just remember thinking, like, this is really happening right now? Like, I was just kind of thinking, like, still the whole time, like, I'm really unlucky. Like, you know, and, I mean, that's just what was really going through my head most of the time. But at this time, I started doing my DMV class, and I remember somebody saying in that DMV class to me repeatedly, if you got 2 DUIs and you keep drinking, you will get another one. And I thought, no, I won't. I'm smarter than you. I put myself through school. This isn't going to happen to me. Right? So, that did stick in my head. I remember that. So, basically, I'm doing this in Fresno for a while. It was a Monday night. I was at the bar because just before that. So I had to sign this piece of paper, right, that basically said that I couldn't come into work drunk or hungover. And I had a positive genius for getting tied at exactly the wrong moment. There was one day that I had to not come in. I had to be there. I couldn't call in sick. I used to keep track on, like, a piece of paper like this, actually, of the people that I worked with and how many days they had called in sick and how many days I had called in sick. And I figured if as long as I haven't called in, like, double the amount of times that they've called in sick, then I'm okay, right? And I remember when they would get another one, and then I'd be like, sweet, I got another one, cool, right? So there was this one day that I absolutely could not call in sick because my supervisor wasn't going to be there, and I had to be there, okay? And I knew that, and I went out that night to have a couple of beers on Thursday night beforehand, and I woke up the next morning, 10 a.m., faded, not even sure how I got home, wasn't sure what exactly had happened, and I just knew I had to be at work, so I went into work to play it off, and this was in November of 07. So November of 07, that happens, and they basically send me home. The guy's like, you got to go home, you're drunk. And I'm just like, wow. And then I got to basically be worried about my whole weekend that I'm going to lose this job, this fairly lucrative job, which basically took me a long time to find, and I've already lost one fairly lucrative job over it. So I remember thinking that, okay, well, this is an issue, but still not thinking anything about it, not interested in seeking out for any kind of help or anything like that. So fast forward now a few months later in March, I got pulled over in the morning taking someone home, and I was positive a week before my last drink that if they breathalyzed me, I was going to get another DUI. I knew it, and it didn't even faze me. Like, I just went out the next week and proceeded to get another DUI, and even though I got pulled over like a week before. So As I got sober and I look back on this, I don't want to spend too much more time on my drunk log, but, you know, as I look back, I didn't notice it at the time, but, okay, there's 3 DUIs that I got, and I got me drinking, driving, and police were on the scene 5 other times, and I got out of it. 5 other times in different states. And I totaled a rental car in there, numerous other times. I had my nose broken one time. I was the kind of drunk that basically always was in these 5-on-2 situations, and I was always on the 2 side. And I have an idea what that's about today, but for a long time I didn't know why that was. You know, I've had my nose broke, had my nose rebroken, been knocked out. I still got gravel here in my face from getting hit upside the head with something and falling over, you know, face first on the asphalt. And it's like a constant reminder for me that of, like, some of the damage that I've done to myself. So, my last drunk, like I said, was Monday. Okay, I go to pool practice. I was in a pool league. Great reason to be in a bar, right? It's a valid reason to be in a bar on a Monday, Tuesday night, right? So I got my pool league on Tuesday nights, and then I go into the bar on Monday nights to practice. I go in there, I only meant to have a pitcher of beer. I had one 60-ounce pitcher of beer, and then some not smart person left a $100 bill on the bar, and I was like, I'm Captain Nice Guy and stuff, and I'm like, hey, this is not the kind of bar you leave a $100 bill in here on, right? So that guy bought me a pitcher, so I drank that pitcher, and then now I'm 2 pitchers in, I'm like, well, I'll have one more because I'm waiting for somebody to show up, and by the time that did, and then I had one more after that because I was already 3 in, right? So now that's basically, I'm 4 pitchers, 4 60-ounce pitchers deep. My friend had taken me there. I didn't even drive to the bar. And then the girl that I was dating showed up to the bar. And I'm looking at her and looking at me as we're about to leave the end of the night. And I'm like, well, I told her that I'm straighter than she is. Let's go. So we go and we drive down the road, and then I get pulled over, of course, and I find myself in the back of the cop car yet again, and I'm looking at myself in the mirror in the back of the cop car, and I'm like, and I just remember saying to myself, this isn't working. And I remember what that guy said in that DMV class, and he said, if you got two DUIs and you keep drinking, you're going to get another one. And I thought, I have an issue here. And for the first time, it really dawned on me that I'm not just unlucky. Like, three times is not unlucky, you know. And, you know, basically, so at that point, I wake up the next day. The book talks about basically, you know, incomprehensible demoralization, waking up the next day, thinking all this, I'm thinking I'm going to lose my job, I think I'm 31, I'm going to go back to where I was when I was 28, and I don't know if I can do that again. I'm not really sure, like, I don't know anything about ego at that point, I don't know, like, about my pride as an instinct or anything like that, but I'm just not sure I can take that again. And so my lawyer, I get a lawyer, and the lawyer says, I don't know why anybody gets a lawyer for a DUI, but I got a lawyer for a DUI, and he told me to go to AA, and he told me to go to 3 meetings a week, and I said, you know what, I'll do anything you want to do if it's going to help me keep my job. You want me to go 3 meetings a week? I'll drop and give you 50 right now. I'll go to 6 meetings a week, and I went to a lot of meetings. And but still the whole time not really thinking that I'm an alcoholic, because I don't really know what an alcoholic is. It's never really been explained to me. Like, I thought an alcoholic was a guy living in a van down by the river. I thought an alcoholic was a guy like Nick Nolte in, like, Down and Out in Beverly Hills. I thought, like, you know, you had to have a trench coat and pushing a shopping basket. And, I mean, an alcoholic's a number of different things, right? But that's just what I thought. And that wasn't me. So since that wasn't me, I thought that I'm not in that situation, right? So come in there, and all these people are saying, like, a lot of different things. And I'm still really looking for an out. I got to be honest. I'm, like, looking for an out. I'm like, I'm not like those people. Those people, they said this, and that didn't happen to me, and that wasn't like that. And then they said this, and I was still looking for all the ways that I was different. And it was pretty easy for me to find something about each person about how I was not the same. And I could be like, well, see, you know, that's not me. I'm just going to do this until I get these people with the court off my back, and then I'll be on my way again. Never thinking the whole time that my last drink had already occurred. So, God willing that my last drink had already occurred. So, basically, I'm coming to the meetings, and people are talking about stuff. Well, look for the similarities. And as I started to look for the similarities, people started saying, and I started to listen to stuff. I thought, well, I'll listen. I'll try and, you know, make the most of this while I'm here. And I started to notice that there were similar things from their stories to mine. Like, things like getting tight at exactly the wrong time. They would say things to me like, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And I'm like, that's ridiculous. It's not the first drink that gets me drunk. That's crazy. One is too many and 1,000 is not enough. I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. One is too many and 1,000 is not enough. How is that possible? If I drank 1,000 drinks, I'd be dead. So I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. And but it got me thinking, right? Like, they would say stuff that didn't make sense to me. It was counterintuitive. And then it got my head thinking about what was going on. So I started to relate with people, and I remember I went to 11 meetings before someone asked me, and I said, I'm Rob, I'm an alcoholic. It was my 11th meeting, and I remember doing that, and I remember coming out of that meeting and just being, like, really wired up and feeling like hella apeshit and, like, in disbelief that this is where my life had taken me. And at that point, I'm riding my bicycle around. I'm in imminent fear that I'm going to lose my job. And, you know, I'm 31 years old, and I kind of can't believe, like, how I've gotten here, right? And at that point, basically, this guy came up to me, this old guy, and he said, hey, you want to get together and read this book? And, you know, honestly, if the guy had said to me, hey, do you want to sponsor? Or if he'd have said, can I sponsor you, or anything like that, I probably would have told him to kick rocks, because I just wasn't in for that much commitment. I just wasn't in for, like, signing up for anything more at that point. But the way he said it to me was, like, just non-committal enough for me to get started. So we got together 1 week, and we started reading the book. He asked me to read the doctor's opinion, and I read it. I came back, and we met. And we met at 10 a.m. on Saturday mornings. And so then we met a few times, and I heard all these other people start talking about sponsors. And I was like, okay, so we had met like 3 times, and I finally got up the nerve to ask him. I'm like, so are you my sponsor, or like what? And so he said to me, he's like, well, do you want to call me that? And I was like, I don't know. And then he just kind of like left it at that. And then I realized when I got home, I was like, he didn't really answer my question. And I still wasn't sure for a while, and but I figured it out, you know, after a bit. So we were doing that, and I remember at that time the most important thing to me really was my relationship and was me keeping my job. And what happened was is I started to work the steps with him, and he started to show me things about myself. Particularly, I spent a lot of time on my first step. I think the Big Book spends a lot of time on the first step for a reason, and I really wasn't sure that I was alcoholic. I mean, I was fighting it. You know, I was just fighting it the whole time. And so I like to consider myself a numbers person. I'm a computer programmer by trade, and so I like, you know, to think that I'm rational, right? So I would look at these things. They would have this little Johns Hopkins test in the back of the thing. It's a little tan-colored pamphlet that they have in some places. And they have this 12 questions test, right? And I'd say, oh, I'm alcoholic, but I don't think I'm that alcoholic or whatever. And I remember taking that 20-question test home one time and doing it the first time, and I wasn't real honest the first time, and answering yes to 14 out of the 20 questions, and then looking down to the bottom and them saying, if you answer yes to one of these, you might be alcoholic. If you answer yes to two, you probably are. Three, you're definitely an alcoholic. And I was like, I don't know that it's 1, 2, or 3, but I figured it was less than 10. And so when I got honest about some more questions, I find that I answered yes to 17 out of those 20 questions. If you don't know if you're an alcoholic, I highly encourage you to do that stuff. There's also the 12 question pamphlet, which says 12 questions only you can answer. It's very, it was very useful for me. It's also on AA.org, that particular 12-question thing. When I did the 12-question one and I answered the questions, I answered yes to 10 out of the 12 questions. And I used to keep that Johns Hopkins thing on my fridge like a grade school quiz, like 14 out of 20. And to this day, like when the mental obsession returns for me, which at times it can if I get crazy enough, like, I still get the visual of that 14 out of 20. Like, that doesn't lie. That's not someone's opinion. That's not like someone else telling me, oh, you got a drinking issue and judging me and all this stuff. That quiz doesn't know nothing about me. Doesn't know nothing about Rob S., right? And I do that, and I can't deny that. So that was very useful for me in the beginning, right? And then I started to think, okay, well, let's back up a little bit. Reading the doctor's opinion is talking about this thing as an allergy, right? It's like the people are physically different, that alcoholics are actually physically different than other people. And I got to tell you, I thought it was a crock. I mean, I came here and I was like, that's a crock. I don't really think that people are physically different. And if I'm real honest, the reason that I thought that was a crock was because there were alcoholics in my life that I didn't want to let off the hook. So I didn't want to let those people off the hook. So I thought if they were physically, like, you know, kind of predisposed to do this, then I would have to, like, let them go. And I didn't want to let those resentments go. And so I didn't want to recognize that for myself. But what I did do was I was taught in the beginning to ask myself questions from the book. I don't know if you're like me. I never read the preface to anything. I never read the forewords. I never read the table of contents. If there was 12 steps, I had to be a third of the way through the steps before I got started. You know what I mean? And but in the preface, there's these three questions. It says, at the end of the preface, it says, we'll hope you'll pause in reading these stories and ask yourself, has this happened to me? Have I felt like that? And do I believe this program can work for me too? And I was told to turn statements into questions. So as I was reading stuff from the book, right, I would basically turn statements into questions, right? And so I'm going to read this from the book, like, just to give you an example of what I'm talking about. Maybe you're doing this already, maybe you're not, but it was not something that I did on my own, right? I had to be shown how to do this. Wow, it's really quiet. Okay, it says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. So I ask myself, does Rob drink because he likes the effect produced by alcohol? Yes, he does. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate between the true and the false. Do I admit the sensation is elusive? I can't quite put my finger on it. Do I admit that it's does Rob admit that it's injurious? Hell yeah, it's injurious. Did I have problems with differentiating between the true and the false? Well, I just told you I did that 20-question test and I answered yes, it's a true, false. And I answered yes to 14 of them, and then later I come back and I answer yes to 17 of them. That's a basic problem with being able to tell the difference between the true and the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one, which means they can't envision an existence without it. Could Rob envision an existence without alcohol? Absolutely not. They are restless, irritable, and discontent unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Am I restless? Which means, unsatisfied, irritable, which means easily annoyed, discontented. Yes, I'm all those things. Unless I can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Does Rob see other people taking the same drinks and get away with it? Yeah, I see all kinds of people out there drinking and not having the problems that I'm having. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomena of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. Have I passed through the stages constantly, over and over again, spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again? Yeah, I've done that. Has it been repeated over and over? Yeah, it's been repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. So, like, when I ask myself those questions, the book begins to come alive for me, and it's like a pop-up. I start to see myself in the middle of the pages. They're not just writing about some dude in 1939 now. Now they're writing about me, right? Because my experience is confirming what this book says. And then I begin to realize, oh, I'm really in the right place. So back to the phenomenon of craving. Like, with the phenomenon of craving, I'm like, okay, I don't really believe that, but, you know, I went to school at a school that had a lot of Asian people there, and I used to have a good friend of mine, Alex, and Alex used to drink, and every time Alex had only, like, one beer, his face would get, like, real red, and I thought, well, clearly something physically different is happening to that guy, right? Is it conceivable that if something physically different happens to that guy, which is visible, that something different happens to me, which is not visible? But certainly that's conceivable. And then the book says something like, it explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. And see, if I don't have the phenomenon of craving, I don't have any explanation for that day when I knew I had to be at work, and all those various times where I knew I had to be there, and I couldn't call in sick, and I couldn't get out of it, and yet I still showed up drunk. Because I only went out to have a few before, and then the phenomenon of craving kicked in, and then I was off to the races, and then I was in that situation again. So the phenomenon of craving, this physical allergy, this idea that I'm different than other people, explains many things for which I cannot otherwise account. So I say, okay, fine, I'm powerless over alcohol. Certainly my life's unmanageable because I'm riding my bicycle around to work, right? So my life's unmanageable because of all this external stuff, right? So I'm powerless over alcohol, but I'm thinking I'm powerless once it gets in me. I'm powerless once I put the drink in me. And now I've been sober, 3, 4 months, 5 months. I got this thing wired. And, and this thing they're talking about, the mental obsession, right, which is the idea that someday somehow I'll be able to control and enjoy my drinking. And I'm trying to explain to you, like, my experience with these steps, and I hope that's what I'm doing. This control and enjoy thing, I thought, well, I know this now. You know what? I'm 4 or 5 months sober, and I know that I have this problem, and maybe I'm just making too big a deal of this, right? Maybe I don't need to go to these 6 meetings a week. Maybe I can ease up here. And I went to a meeting one time, and this guy laid this big old drunk trap for me. He basically said to me, he's like, there's a lot of people in these meetings, they ain't real alcoholics. That's what he said to me. And I went home, and I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I started thinking, well, maybe I'm in that group. So I went back and I brought this up with my sponsor. And my sponsor said, do you realize, Rob, that that's you experiencing the mental obsession, that someday, somehow, you'll be able to control and enjoy your drinking? And I did not realize it. And here I am, 5 months sober, and I've done all this work to identify myself as an alcoholic, and I'm positive I'm an alcoholic, and then all it does is take somebody, some jackass in a meeting to say, right, to basically say this to me, and I'm ready to go jump ship. Just one little comment, and I'm ready to throw the whole thing away. And I'm like, that's when I really realized for me, like, I'm not just powerless when I put the drink in, I'm powerless without having the drink in my system. Left to my own devices on a long enough timeline, I will drink again. That's when I knew I was, like, that's really when I knew, like, I was in a bad place. And it really, it was, it sucked. I'm not going to lie. It was not fun to understand that. And because I thought at some point I was going to graduate from this. I thought I was going to put some time together, and I thought this was going to be enough, right? And so basically then that leads me into, like, you know, and I have new first step experiences, like, all the time, and I'm still having new first step experiences. And, late, you know, they would talk about the spiritual malady, like selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. And I realized I was selfish, but I didn't understand why that was a problem. And it took me a couple of years to figure that out. And I'll just tell you, that if it hasn't been explained to you, the problem with your selfishness and self-centeredness is that it leads to all this stuff. I thought my life was unmanageable because I was riding my bicycle, because I had DUIs. But that's not why my life's unmanageable. My life's unmanageable because I live with this stuff on a daily basis when left to my own devices. It says on page 52, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. Was Rob having trouble with personal relationships? Absolutely. We couldn't control our emotional natures. Could Rob control his emotional nature? No, I flew off the handle. That's why I was always in those 2-on-5 situations. We were a prey to misery and depression. Was I a prey to misery and depression? Absolutely. We couldn't make a living. I was losing jobs on my mom's couch, almost going back there. We had a feeling of uselessness. Absolutely. Was I full of fear? Definitely. Was I unhappy? Yes. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of Lunar 5? Basically, whether we should understand, whether we should see the future. So, like, all that stuff, that's my unmanageability. That's my internal stuff. That's why my life is in not a good place. It's not because, I mean, sure, I'm dealing with these symptoms of my alcoholism, right? I'm dealing with the DUI, and I'm dealing with all those external things. But really, it's the internal stuff that makes my life unmanageable. And so I'm selfish and self-centered, and being selfish and self-centered leads to those things. And when it leads to those things for me, even after I've been sober for a while, my head says, that's been a minute. One Bud Light's not going to kill you. You know what I mean? I mean, really, one Bud Light, it's going to be the end of your life like that? That's how it's going to go down? See, because my head gets in a place where you would think that if I was in a squirrely spot or whatever, that, you know, my head would say, warning, danger, you know, you're in not a good place. But that's not what my head does. My head seeks for an immediate sense of ease and comfort to resolve that. And so my selfishness, self-centeredness leads to this unmanageability, this stuff on page 52. And then when I'm in that for long enough, the mental obsession returns. And it says, you can control and enjoy this. And it's not just that I can control and enjoy it and nothing will happen, but I can control how bad it's going to get. I won't get another DUI. I won't go back to jail. I won't lose my job. Sure, I'll pick up a new sobriety date, but I mean, it won't be that bad. I mean, you just come back in here and do this shit again, right? That's what my head tells me. So if I sit in that mental obsession long enough, then basically I'm prone to pick up a drink. And that's my experience, right? So that's kind of like my understanding of the first step. So then that leads me to now, okay, I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless for 3 reasons. I'm powerless because this physical thing, this phenomenon of craving, this allergy that I'm different, I'm powerless because of this mental thing, this weird twist of my thinking that says, you can go do this again. You know, when I was 5 years old, I put my hand on a hot stove. I never had to go do that again. Never had to go do that again. But with this drinking and drug stuff, I just keep going back. I just keep going back, thinking it's going to be different, thinking it won't burn me this time. That's something wrong in my thinking. And I'm powerless over alcohol because I'm selfish and I'm self-centered, and that ultimately leads me to a place where the mental obsession can take over again. So now I'm left with the second step, right? Second step is basically that I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And that's sanity about, like, what a drink means to me, okay? And I thought I had tried the God thing when I got here. I thought I had done it. I went to church when I was younger, of course, for a girl. Why does anybody else go to church? So I went to church for a girl, and then it didn't work out. I tried it for a while. I thought I really tried it. And I thought, you know, it just didn't work out for me. And the problem was for me, and I don't know if it's like this for other people, but this was my problem with God. I thought I was in a transactional relationship with God. I thought, I did this for you, God, and you're supposed to give me this. I'll go to church on Sunday, I'll go to Bible study on Wednesday, but you're supposed to give me these things that I want. And if I don't get these things, then I'm out. You know what I mean? I mean, that's basically what happened. And I did it for a while, and then I basically went my own way. And when I went my own way, I started drinking for 10 years and went through all that. And then when I got here, my sponsor would always ask me, Rob, well, how well is that working for you? And I was convinced, a part of the book says, you know, that the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And I was convinced when I got here that Rob doing it Rob's way wasn't working anymore. And I got more convinced as I listened to other people. And that made me willing to, like, take some suggestions. And quite frankly, I didn't like this God thing. I wasn't about it. I really didn't want to have to do it. And but the main thing that brought me to the God thing is this other thing on page 52. And that is when it says this. When we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. So see, there's all these people here, right, with similar situations to yours. Maybe not the exact precise details, right, but similar types of things. And there's plenty of people here with a solution, and they're telling you that this is how we got through it. We got through it by having a relationship with a higher power. And I didn't like that when I got here either. But I saw that it works for them. And the thing that mainly stuck out for me, I remember this one time in a meeting, this guy said, you know, how do you get through them? There's all these little cliches, and different ones stick for different people. And if something sticks for you, I encourage you to keep thinking about it, because it'll hit different people at different times in different ways. But the thing that stuck in my head about doing the steps and about this higher power thing was somebody said to me one time in a meeting, how do you get through a minefield? And I don't know, I felt like I was in a minefield. I felt like my buddy's going to turn the corner with a 12er, and what am I going to do, tell him no? Like, really? Like, I'm really going to just tell him no? Like, I've never done that, and I'm going to do that. And they said, and I'm like, I don't know. And they said, well, you go in the footsteps of the guy that went before you. And I got the visual of a minefield with holes all over the place, and this dude standing on the other side of the minefield, right, and footsteps going to where he is. And I thought, well, that's really simple. That seems to make sense. I'm like, I think I can do that. So then basically I had to start somewhere with this God thing. And basically for me, where I started with the God thing was, you know, I was not an atheist. I never really was. Like Bill talks about in Bill's story, I did not believe in the proposition that all this stuff came from nowhere. And my sponsor encouraged me to, like, pray through the first three steps every day. And the thing that I would pray a little part of the big book when I go through each step, right? And the part that I would pray the thing that I would say to myself when I went through the second step is I would say, could we still say, this is on page 54, could we still say the whole thing was nothing but a mass of electrons created out of nothing, meaning nothing, and whirling on towards a destiny of nothingness? And I thought, it takes more faith for me to believe that all this stuff happened randomly, that the sun is just so far from the earth, that we have liquid water, that everything is just the way that it is, that the periodic table is lined up just so perfectly and whatnot, right? It takes more faith for me to believe that that happened randomly by chance than to believe that something, and I don't know what that is, and I don't know if it's Jesus, and I don't know if it's Allah, and I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, that something set it up. And that's where I started. And I started saying real honest things to that, whatever that was in the morning, like, look, God, if you're there, whatever you are, like, I need some help here, because I'm not buying this, and I don't know if this is going to work for me. And I really don't believe it's going to work, and actually, I'm probably only doing this to say that I really gave this a shot, because I never really gave anything else in my life, like, a serious, real shot. I half-assed everything. I shortcut everything. I thought I was smart enough to, like, cut corners here, cut corners there. And I don't want to get to the end of this road and say that I half-assed this too and have this not work and look back like I do on all the rest of that stuff and think, well, did I really give that a shot? Did I really put my back into it? Because I never really put my back into most things. So That's where I started with the second step. And then what happened was little strange things started happening to me. Little strange things started happening to me that I couldn't just chalk up to chance. And, you know, like I would be doing some writing about somebody in a step, and then I would see that person, you know, and I'd be like, how's that possible? What are the chances of that? That's pretty odd, you know. Or, you know, I would catch a break in some sort of situation, you know, and I would be like, that stuff wasn't really happening before. Why am I catching these breaks now? And, or I would hear just the right thing at just the right moment, and it seemed to apply. Or I would go to this meeting, and I would hear this one thing from this one person, and then I would go to this other meeting, and this other person would say the same thing, and it was, like, totally related. And I was like, well, how's that? How's that? This other person doesn't know this other person, and there's so many different things that could be said. How could they be saying something that is, like, totally related to this other person, and yet they don't know nothing about each other? What's going on there? And little things start happening like that to me that basically led me to believe that there's something else going on here, something else is running the show, and it's not me. And so that's where I get with the second step, right? And then I get into the third step, and you know, for me, the third step, I struggled a lot with the concept that, you know, I was going to turn my will and my life over to something. I struggled with it the first time through, and probably I remember the first time through, like, I was with my sponsor, and my sponsor was taking me and this other guy through the steps at the same time, and he asked us all to, like, kneel down and pray the third step prayer, like, the same time, and I was like, really? I'm like, I don't even get, like, my own third step thing, like, I can't even have, like, my own time, like, you're gonna do the third step, I gotta do my third step prayer with this guy, and, like, I have to share it with this guy? I'm like, what the hell, I can't have my own thing? And, so, I don't know, I just remember that. So now, like, you know, some other significant things that have happened to me along the way with, like, some of the steps, you know, I'm a programmer and I code an inventory control application and it keeps track of parts. So when it says a business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke, I thought, that's odd. Why would I be a programmer for an inventory control application and now I'm over here got to do this inventory? So I could understand, like, what an inventory was because I worked on that stuff. And it made sense to me. And so I started doing it. And the first time through the steps, I went through 1 through 5. Okay? And I'll just be straight up, like, it was real easy for me to tell you who I was pissed off at. It was real easy to tell you why. It was easy for me to say what it affected. But I couldn't figure out, like, what my part in it was. I was just too, I couldn't really see it. I couldn't really see, like, what my part in so many different situations was. And so I did my fifth step, and I had all this, you know, I kind of half-assed filled it out or whatever, but, like, it wasn't real. Like, I really didn't get my part in a lot of these different situations. So I did my fifth step with my sponsor. My sponsor said, well, go home and see if you're experiencing these fifth step promises, and then come back, right? So some of the fifth step promises, right? Returning, okay, once we have taken this step of holding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the dream problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel that we are on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. And I came back to Jack, and Jack said to me, well, how do you feel? And I, like, said, Jack, I'm not walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. And Jack didn't look sideways, he didn't blink, he didn't go like, well, I thought he was going to give me a pep talk. In fact, Jack just looked blankly at me and he said, well, I guess we missed something, we better go back. And I said, what? I said, no pep talk, no whatever? And he's like, yeah, he's like, I can't tell you for sure what you missed, but we missed something, so we better go back. And what I understood was basically for me that was a grow or go moment. Like, I was either going to do that and stick around here, or I was going to say, to hell with you, I'm off to go do my own program again, and back to my old deal. And so basically, I just felt like for me, by the grace of God, I was aware that I didn't really have any other options, because I didn't have any other solutions, and I didn't want to be going through this stuff anymore. Also, conveniently, at that time in my life, I got out of a relationship, which I had, and I was in the middle of a security blanket relationship when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a relationship that I had no intention of being in, like, for a long period of time. And it was just a sense of ease and comfort. And when you remove the sense of ease and comfort that comes from a drink or a drug, I want a sense of ease and comfort to come from somewhere else. And I don't really want to do all this work that it takes to get it from God, so I'm going to go to romance and I'm going to go to finance to get it. Right? So I went to romance and I went to finance. I focused on my job. I became a workaholic for a while, like it talks about in the book. And then I also went through this relationship thing. When I got out of that relationship thing, I wasn't going to get my license for another 9 months. And at that point, I knew that, okay, well, if I'm not going to get my license for another 9 months, like, what am I going to do? Say, hey, jump on my handlebars? You know what I mean? So I was like pretty sure that, like, I was going to be single for that period of time, right? For the first time, I was like, this 9 months, I'm single this 9 months, right? So, like, so that's basically, it was the first time in my life where I had, like, enforced singlehood, I felt like. And I was like, okay, and that was really beneficial to me because I went through my steps now. And I felt, like, honestly, when he asked me to do that, I felt like I had a relapse, but I didn't have a relapse. I felt like I was going back to the beginning again. It felt to me like a relapse without a relapse. So we went through my steps again, and I was real diligent this time. And I was really picking up on things this time. And it was very useful for me. And basically, the next time that I did a fifth step, I had a very different experience. And I could really see what my part was. And it was very eye-opening to realize that I am my own biggest problem. I did not know that. My mom would always say to me stuff like, you know, Robert, you're your own biggest problem. But whatever. And I just marginalize it because I've heard it my whole life. That can't possibly be true if everybody's saying it. And, right? So, like, I just didn't believe that. And then through the inventory process, I started to see that. And so that's really good news, and it's really bad news, right? And it's good news because if I'm my own biggest problem, I'm not a victim anymore. Like, I'm not a victim of, like, where I grew up. I'm not a victim of the fact of my upbringing. I'm not a victim of the court case didn't go my way. I'm not a victim of this didn't happen and that didn't happen. But I can actually do something about it. And the bad news is that I have to do something about it. Right? So, like he said, my favorite policy is he does it, but do it. You know, You got to do stuff in this program. It's an action program. You can't think your way out of this thing, is my experience. I thought a lot, and I can't think my way out of this. I have to take action, and that's what helps. And I was told to get into service, and I eventually got into service. I'm involved with, like, Fresno County Young People's in AA, and I'm going to try and wrap it up here in a second. I'm involved with Fresno County Young People's in AA, and I'm thankful for that. And the funny thing I find about that is that, you know, everybody's got an excuse. If you're too young, you're too young to do it. You know, you got more in you. You got another run. You can go again a little bit longer, right? And if you're too old, well, I've been doing this for too long. How am I going to make any changes now? Right? So, and you don't see that. Like, when you're young or you're old, you just look for your particular excuse and you hang your hat on it. You're not too young to do this, and you're not too old to do this. People do it. People are doing it everywhere. And it does begin when one alcoholic talks with another. And so, my sponsor would say things to me like, you know, this has helped me more than it's helping you. And I'd be like, you're full of shit. I'm like, it's not helping you. I'm like, I'm going crazy here, and if I wouldn't have these conversations, I don't know what I would do, right? So he'd be like, no, this is really helping me more than it's helping you. And now I get the privilege and the honor of working with guys and taking them through the steps the same way I was taking through the steps. And I realize it's helping me more than it's helping them. And I'm baffled by it. And it's really a privilege and an honor, and it's a privilege and an honor to be here. You know, if you're new or relatively new and you don't know if you're an alcoholic, it boils down to like two questions, and that's if when you honestly want to quit, you find you cannot. Or if when drinking you have little control of the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. Okay? That's the main thing. The book, they spend 100-some pages on the first 12 steps, and they spend up to 45 pages on the first step. If they were all, like, really equally as important, right, there'd be 8 pages on each step. They spend half the deal, plus the forewords and all that other stuff, talking about the first step. That means the first step is really important. That means you really got to get it. In the 12 and 12, it says it's the only step we can do 100%. So I would encourage you to basically get real clear on that. Or if you've been around here a while and you're starting to think, well, maybe I'm not quite like these people. Maybe I'm a little different. Maybe I've grown out of this now. Maybe this isn't me now, right? Because I've known some people. I had a friend just pick up some time, who had some time, more years than me, and, you know, basically picked up a new date. And, you know, he just got disconnected. And that's what can happen for me. So how I stay connected is I have a group that I'm committed to. A sponsor explained to me that there's three legs to the triangle. You know, you've got this unity leg, and that's the fellowship, and that's the 12 traditions. And that's, are you committed to a group? Right? And then I've got this other leg, recovery leg, at the bottom, and that's the 12 steps. And where am I at in the 12 steps? And then he explained to me, I've got this service leg over here, and this service leg is like the 12 concepts and carrying the message. Right? So if I want to be in AA, where am I at in each one of those areas of my life? It's like a stool with three legs. You take out one leg and it can fall over. So, it might be real convenient for me. I like meetings, to go to meetings. It might be real convenient for me to basically work steps, because I'll work steps. But maybe I don't want to be involved in service. Or maybe I've been around here a while and I'll do unity and I'll do service, but I got the steps. I graduated from that. I'm good. Right? Well, it's not like that. The steps should be up there on the wall like a clock going around. And it's not linear. And I continue to, at this point in my sobriety, I continue to have new first step experiences. And if you're relatively new, please get clear on your first step. It's the best thing that you can do. If you're not sure if you're an alcoholic, get real clear on it. And, and I'll say this about, I've said a bunch of different things. That's all I really got. I wanted to thank you guys for asking me to come here and share my experience, strength, and hope with you guys. And I hope you got something out of that. Thank you for the time.